This weekend, in between hot dogs and fireworks or sitting in traffic, a lot of us are probably taking a minute to think about what it means to be American. Whatever else we come up with, it's hard to deny a profound sense of change, wrestling with the rules of this new economy and where we fit in it. That sense of transition, that's what our show's about this week. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of July 4th, 2014. This is a special show, fitting for Independence Day, because we're going to hear from the President of the United States. And then we want to hear from you. What do you think of what he has to say? Come and talk to us online at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But first, here's your Economic Week in 20 seconds.
People now owe about $218 billion in home equity lines of credit.
This decision could give certain companies a competitive advantage on the basis of religion.
June coming in, according to the Labor Department, with 288,000 jobs added.
Although the economy has been growing, wages and incomes continue to be relatively stagnant.
That last voice, yep, that was the President of the United States speaking to our very own Kai Ryssdal. And we've asked Kai to come on and talk about his interview with President Obama. Hi, Kai.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So we just heard Obama talk about that sort of stagnation for people in the middle of this economy. Did you get a sense that's something he feels like he can do anything about in his second term?
The sense overwhelmingly that you get when you sit down with this guy is that he's just frustrated, right? He is frustrated with the politics of Washington. He's frustrated by a recovering but still a little bit stuck economy and the fact that the middle class is still having a really hard time. I don't know that he feels he can do anything about it at this point, but he is playing the game and he is trying to do all he can. You know, we've had these conversations about executive orders and all of that stuff, and he's doing, I think, the best that he thinks he can do.
On Dodd-Frank, the Wall Street reform bill, you pushed him pretty hard on that point. I want to play that. Let's listen.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that the goal of Dodd-Frank was to prevent another catastrophic financial crisis. It wasn't expected that it was going to solve all the problems.
But you get that it's small steps, right?
Some of these are not small steps. I mean, the fact of the matter is, for example, we have massively increased the capitalization requirements in banks. And what that means is that they've got more of a cushion. If they screw up and make a bad bet, they're less likely to need to be bailed out because they've got to have a certain amount of capital on hand.
So there were some tough words for banks in this interview, but does the administration feel like they've actually changed all that much in the financial world? I mean, the big banks are bigger than they were before.
Right. I think he believes that the banking system in this country is less of a threat to public safety, if you will, than it was in 2007, 2008. You know, and we can go back and forth on whether Dodd-Frank has actually done anything, and Democrats and Republicans in Wall Street will all have different opinions. But the White House is firm in its belief that they have done what they can do. Now, the president did say in that interview that he wants further reforms of the banking system. I think that, you know, that's pie in the sky, right? I mean, the odds of him getting anything through Congress right now are less than zero. But it is part of his populist move now to do what he can by himself. And if he thinks talking a tough game with the banks will help him in other ways, that's what he's going to do.
Let's turn to the Veterans Administration. He has named Bob McDonald, former head of Procter & Gamble, to take over. You asked what he expects McDonald to do. Let's play that.
What I've said to Bob is that I expect the kind of attention to detail, structural reform, staffing with people who are about results as opposed to just being in a job. And Bob has a really strong track record. And obviously, Procter & Gamble is one of the biggest corporations in the world, so he's accustomed to dealing with large agencies.
So how do those expectations of one guy stack up against the enormity of this problem?
So the actual question I asked was, how many people, and this is only roughly paraphrasing, how many people are you willing to have Bob McDonald fire to fix these systemic problems in the Department of Veterans Affairs? Because it is, as his own report said, a corrosive management culture, right? It's a big management problem. He dodged that question. I think the short answer is McDonald will not be allowed to fire as many people as need to probably be fired. Let's remember the Department of Veterans Affairs is the second largest agency in this government behind only the actual Pentagon itself. But, you know, Obama is doing what he can, right? I mean, he appreciates more than anybody the inability of a single leader at the top of any single organization to affect things deep down where the rubber meets the road, if you will. So I think he understands McDonald's limitations, but he expects from McDonald the tone of leadership that will let people in the VA know that what has happened to date to veterans in this country is flat unacceptable.
I covered the president early on in his 2007 campaign. You have interviewed the president before. What was your takeaway in this interview? What has changed?
I think he is more tired. And I say that not in just the physical sense, although the amount of energy, just, you know, being around him for 15 minutes, the amount of energy it takes to be the president is staggering. I think he is tired now of the process. I think he is tired of rolling that boulder uphill all the time. And that is not to take away from Republicans in Congress who genuinely believe, and he said this in his speech the other day that we referenced in the interview, Republicans genuinely believe that what they are doing is in their own patriotic interest. And that's a paraphrase of what he said. But I think he's tired of that. I think he's tired of not being able to get things done because of a small handful of people in the Republican Party. And I think it's deeply, deeply frustrating for him.
Kai Ryssdal, thank you so much.
You bet.
Now's the part of the show where we dig a little deeper into a story that you, our audience, found particularly compelling this week. And one piece that sparked a ton of online conversation is Ashley Milne-Tite's look at how transgender female employees face added discrimination at work. And we brought Ashley back to tell us more about the story. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Recap sort of the crux of your piece.
So basically, the story was about what happens when somebody transitions, either male or female, and how they're then treated in the workplace. And obviously, if you have been in the workplace, if you have operated in the workplace as both genders, you have a pretty unique perspective on how men and women are treated there. So that was the crux of the story.
Tell me about Susan and Thomas. This was the anecdote that kind of blew me away.
Yeah, so I found out about this research through this sociologist at the University of Chicago called Kristen Schilt, and she had interviewed lots of transgender men about their workplace lives, and one of them was called Thomas, and he had begun life at his law firm as Susan. And everyone in the firm knew that he was transitioning, and they were all on board with it. But the firm did not let outsiders know, like clients and other firms. So one outside lawyer said, "Oh, you know, I'm so glad that you got rid of Susan, because I found her to be very incompetent, but I really like this new guy, Thomas." And he had no idea that they were the same person with the same abilities. It's just that Thomas now looked like a guy.
I mean, that says so much about things far beyond transitioning, but just about gender in the workplace.
Exactly. I mean, I first started my research on this for my podcast, which is all about women in the workplace. It's called The Broad Experience. So I'm always looking for new angles on this topic. And when I found out about Kristen Schilt's research, I thought, that is fascinating. You know, her original research was about what transgender guys' experiences are like and what that tells us about how women are treated in the workplace. And it does reveal a lot, I think, because these people have actually had experience of being each gender. So they can really speak to what it's like, especially when they surface in the workplace, you know, living outwardly as a man.
Yeah, I want to bring in one comment from our Facebook page. Someone named Allie wrote in saying a close friend transitioned the other way. As a female, she now gets challenged on her software development work far more than she ever did as a male. You dug into this part of it a little bit in your podcast.
Yeah, and that's sort of sad and true, because I interviewed a trans woman called Lisa Sheps, and she doesn't work in tech, but she also has found just her authority is constantly questioned. She said, "I was a very successful male entrepreneur, but now that I'm a woman in the marketplace, I find that I am just questioned all the time." And it was so new for her. It's taken her a really long time to get used to that, because she was such a success previously. And actually, talking of women in tech, one of the trans guys that Kristen Schilt interviewed had been a woman in the tech space for many years, applied for a job, was rejected. 3 months later, after she had transitioned, so she's now a trans guy, she applied for the same job and landed the job.
Why do the researchers think we're seeing this?
I think a lot of it has to do with unconscious bias. I mean, you could say that that guy who didn't like Susan but thought Thomas was great, I'm sure he doesn't think he's judging those people differently. I'm sure he genuinely thought Susan was incompetent. But what this suggests is that we all have some level of bias, some level of what we think about each gender, what each gender should be and how they should behave and how we think they do behave.
One question that came up from a listener was whether the people in your story felt freer or more confident as themselves after they had transitioned and whether that contributed to this.
Well, yeah, no, I asked that question myself to this sociologist. And she said, well, the problem with that is that when I started interviewing transgender women, she said, they're also really happy and confident and glad to be themselves. And they are not treated the same way in the workplace. So only seems to work one way.
Anything else that surprised you or that got buried in your notebook when you were reporting?
One really interesting thing was that this researcher, she didn't just speak to trans men and trans women. She spoke to their co-workers and had conversations with them. Like, what do you think about what your co-worker is going through? And again, the male co-workers, they didn't have any questions really about people who were going to take testosterone to, you know, as part of their transition to the male state. They didn't have any questions about that. They didn't say, oh, you know, are you going to be angrier? Are we going to have any problems here? But when it was somebody wanting to transition the other way, they had a lot of questions about estrogen. Are you still going to be able to program a computer? Are you going to be thinking about hair and makeup all the time? I mean, incredibly sexist questions that you just seem pretty unbelievable, but they were asking these questions. They were very concerned about what estrogen was going to do to these people.
What are you working on next? I would imagine that it would be hard to go from this story and not have 50 other stories that you want to do that grow out of this.
Yeah. So, well, for Marketplace, I'm working on a story about female entrepreneurs and why only 5% of small businesses that get federal contracts are owned by women. So I'm going to look into that. And then for my own show, I'm looking at the topic of what can happen to a woman's career when she comes back to a company after having a baby.
Major question there.
We'll see what the answer is.
Ashley Milne-Tite, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, void where prohibited, not available everywhere. The fine print. How to protect yourself from getting stung.
Not reading the fine print can cost you more than your privacy, which is a very, very expensive price. But it can also cost you every dollar you have in the bank and then some.
That and a look at the season of LeBron. That's next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. This week online, we've been asking about moments when you got tripped up by the fine print. You know, this stuff.
The presence of a disclaimer in a legally binding agreement does not necessarily
guarantee that your mileage may vary.
The availability of described coverages and other products and services may be limited by
state. Not available in Arizona, Texas, and parts of Nebraska.
Presented in this document are solely those of the author.
Void where prohibited.
Does an experience like this one sound familiar? Here's Emily Green from Los Angeles.
I signed up for Match.com, and then I stopped using it. And I hadn't been using it for months. And then I didn't realize it was still charging me. And one day I went to my bank account when I saw I was being charged a monthly fee by Match. But the fine print apparently said that even when you cancel it, it still is going to charge you for some months after that.
We've got Elise Glink to help us sort through the fine print. She's a financial expert and founder of the money management site thinklink.com. Hi, Elise.
Hi, Lizzie.
Why is it, do you think, that people get tripped up by the fine print so often?
Well, I think there's so much of it. You know, the fine print kind of rules our lives. And we've just seen this come up again where Facebook, once again mortified, once again apologizing for running a social experiment with our personal information. And yet, if you read the fine print, it tells you that they basically have the right to do everything, perhaps even sell your oldest child. I'm not quite sure.
So if you're a consumer, how do you guard against this? What should you look for?
You know, I think it's really impossible to expect everybody to read the fine print. I mean, after all, these lawyers, again, are paid a lot of money to put a lot of jargon in, so it's really confusing, and basically you need the Supreme Court to rule on it. So you're probably not going to be able to read all of the fine print, but there are some documents where I really want you to try, because not reading the fine print can cost you more than your privacy, which is a very, very expensive price, but it can also cost you every dollar you have in the bank and then some. So, for example, on insurance policies, most people, if you've got a homeowner's insurance policy and you go to sell your house and you buy a new house, you think, well, I still have my homeowner's insurance on the old house, even though I've moved to the new house. Nah. What the fine print says is, actually, that you have to convert your old policy to a vacant homeowner policy, so that it covers the house as a vacant property rather than something that you live in. And this difference between vacant, owner-occupied, rental, or investor, those are really important distinctions in all kinds of different policies.
Where are places where you have seen people really get in trouble?
Well, I think mortgages are another place. You've got mortgages that, and we're seeing a lot of this with the HARP refinances, the Home Affordable Refinance program. And so people were assuming that just because their mortgage interest rate was really high, like 8.5%, when the going rate is now, believe it or not, under 4% again for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that they'd just be able to automatically refinance. Well, you could refinance under that program if you were underwater and if you had a Fannie or Freddie loan that didn't have like XYZ insurance program attached to it that you never maybe even knew you had, that would have been outlined in the fine print in your mortgage because nobody ever told you.
Let's say you get hit with something, right? A fee in the fine print. What can you do?
Well, the interesting thing about the way this world works is complaining does help, although you want to complain in a really nice way so that whoever picks up the phone doesn't just hang up on you. But that's a call center issue. I think what's really important to remember is that it costs companies a lot of money to acquire you as a customer, and this is their weak spot. Right? They don't really want you to go away. And so if it's within the power of the person you're talking to, they're going to try and fix your problem. So what you want to do is couch the problem in something that's easily solvable. And if you find something that you're getting stuck for a fee, you don't want to pay that fee, always ask the person what they can do to help you. So for example, with credit cards, let's say you're paying an annual fee and you didn't realize there was an annual fee. Let's say the first year was free and now this $100 fee pops up. Well, you can call the credit card company. You know you don't want to cancel the card, and they don't really want to lose you as a customer. So you can ask them to forgive the fee for the first year or to write it down, and they may do that. Or if they won't, you can say something like, well, is there a way for me to transfer this card to a no-fee card that would still give me the same benefits or some of the same benefits? I'd be able to keep my account open with you and be able to use it, but not have that fee. Asking the question that way gives them an opportunity to actually help you rather than hang up on you.
Have you ever seen the fine print help out a consumer?
Well, not so much, but I do think that it's important to understand how to protect yourself. And for me personally, I read the fine print on a loan one day, and I was very proud of myself in one of our refis, and I saw that the lender had actually put the wrong interest rate down on the loan. It was off by a quarter of a point.
So you saved yourself some money.
I did. I saved myself some money, and they gave us another $250 off the closing costs just for the trouble that we all then went through. It took 3 hours for them to redo the documents at the closing, but we weren't going to sign until it was done. And that's the best thing that you can do, right? Because if you refuse to go along with something once you catch the fine, let's say you catch a mistake in the fine print, not just saying, well, I'll sign now and fix it later, but get it fixed before you sign, because that's when you have all the leverage.
Elise Glink is a personal finance expert. Her website is thinkglink.com. Thanks, Elise.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
This week, we want to know what you would tell your 18-year-old self about money. Let us know on our website, marketplaceweekend.org. Economic change can come on a personal level, too, in a moment where money transforms your life. This week, a Chicago musician talks about why she isn't just an artist, but an entrepreneur, too.
Greetings. My name is Miss Alex White. I have the pleasure of playing guitar in a rock and roll band called White Mystery with my brother Francis Scott Key White, who plays drums, which firstly is a rock and roll band and is also a business that Francis and I share. I grew up on the north side of Chicago, nestled between Lake Michigan and the Chicago River. Went to Chicago public schools my whole life. My mother, Diane, has been a photographer for much of her life. And my dad, Frank, came to Chicago to go to law school. He's an attorney. I distinctly remember the time when both my mom and dad had quit their jobs. And here they have three young kids and a mortgage for their two flat on the north side of Chicago, and both took the risk of starting their own businesses around the same time. While I was a teenager, having played in bands from a young age and starting to play festivals and actually tour regionally, you know, playing Detroit and Milwaukee, we were pursued by a record label, a couple of record labels, about releasing our music. And I discovered that what I wanted to do was self-release that music and retain a creative control over it. My mom saw an article in the Chicago Tribune about DePaul University starting either the first or one of the first entrepreneurship programs at DePaul. And my mom handed me this article and said, "Did you realize that what you do is being an entrepreneur by managing this band, putting the records out, accepting cash and mail orders? What you're doing is you're starting your own business. Would you consider pursuing that after high school?" So what I learned at DePaul was this concept of SMART goals. The first challenge was raising that initial capital, whether it was, you know, dubbing tape cassettes at home, 2 or 3 years of saving $50 or $100 from each show, you know, spray painting your DIY band t-shirts and selling those for $10 and saving that money. You had to be resourceful. But what you find is that when you retain that creative control and what you've built over that time, maybe 2 or 3 years, is that it starts to snowball. And it's really, really exciting when you see it grow exponentially. You know, that exponential curve that people see in finance, that desired graphic shape, starts to take place over time. We just self-released our fourth album. We just got back from a 6-week, 45-show tour in Europe. I mean, when we first started the band, I never expected to be solely employed by it, as well as my brother Francis. It's all we do is play rock and roll. You know, making that decision to be entrepreneurial was very easy because, you know, both of my parents were self-employed. Their actions and their example have really inspired me to do what I do now and think independently and creatively.
Alex White is one half of the Chicago garage rock duo White Mystery. Their latest album is Double Dragon. They tour the U.S. this summer. Tell us your money story at marketplaceweekend.org. I talked about change at the top of the show, and there's a huge shift happening this month in the world of sports. We're in the middle of the free agency period, where NBA players are eligible to sign with any team. And LeBron James, yeah, the king of basketball, is reinventing not only how NBA players get paid, but maybe professional athletes as a whole. We wanted to explore why, so we went down to the legendary West 4th Street basketball courts in New York to meet up with Keith Reed.
I am former senior editor at ESPN Magazine. I'm a sports business analyst. That's what I do. That's me.
Reed called LeBron maybe the only truly free athlete in America.
What LeBron has been able to do, and I think this is very significant, in free agency is really enabled by what he's been able to do off the court. Off the court, LeBron James makes a lot more money, actually, than he does on the court, and that's because the NBA has a salary cap. You know, even if he's on a max contract, there's only a certain amount of money that LeBron can make. LeBron was scheduled to make about $20.5 million going into the 2014 season for the Miami Heat. Well, he was an investor in Beats Electronics. That just sold for $3 billion. He made $30 million sitting on his couch just from that Beats transaction. And so when people talk about, well, why is LeBron, you know, opting out of his contract and what's he going to do? You know, at that stage of the game, he's made his money. So he's free to now negotiate whatever he wants and know that he's going to be straight.
How does that change what other players are doing if you're Dwayne Wade, if you're Chris Bosh, if you're somebody else, if you're not LeBron?
Well, one of the things that LeBron has done is he's made sure that he's been connecting other players to the kinds of business contacts that he has. Now, of course, none of them has as much clout in the business world as LeBron James because none of them is the athlete that he is and none of them is as famous as he is. But he's been making sure that they have some of the same off-court connections as he does. If you look at his friend Chris Paul, Chris Paul was connected with the State Farm commercials that he does through LeBron James. I mean, you know, some of the money that many of his contemporaries are making, they're making that money because LeBron is connecting them with his connections either in the advertising world, the marketing world, investment firms, those sorts of things.
You wrote about this and also put it in terms of largely black players playing for largely white owners, that this is very much about buying a different kind of freedom.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's just about race. I think it's about a number of things outside of race. It's about your ability as labor. I mean, you can take this and make it a meta conversation. This is about labor being able to take away power from the hands of capital. This is about labor being able to control its own destiny to the extent that it can. What LeBron James is doing and what this trend is about is that when you once you have a certain amount of clout, once you are marketable, once you can do things that influence mass numbers of people, then your economic clout increases such that you may become more powerful technically than the person who you work for.
We're talking about guys at the top, though. How does this make its way down to affect the rest of the team and what they can do with their money?
Sure. Well, you know, it's going to be different for the guys at the bottom of the scale, right? I mean, in any instance, the guys at the bottom of the scale are going to have less negotiating power because they're not a LeBron, they're not a Chris Bosh, they're not a Dwayne Wade.
So we called up Brandon Greer, an agent who represents NBA players, a little further down in the hierarchy to find out what that's like.
Well, I mean, it's pressure. You're dealing with, you know, not just an individual's lives, but the families that are affected by it as well. You know, a lot of times these guys are, you know, they're the breadwinners for their family.
Greer's company, Principal Management, represents 4 solid but not superstar NBA players.
I feel an obligation to get every dollar I can for them.
A lot of focus this season has been on, you know, LeBron James and the big star free agents. And this question of whether they're kind of changing the marketplace, right? How does that model change things for up-and-coming players like yours?
Well, there's a trickle-down effect with the markets kind of at a standstill until those guys make a decision.
When your younger players look at those superstars, do they think, someday I'm going to be able to have that kind of clout?
I don't think that a lot of young players look at LeBron, you know, and think that they'll have that clout one day. I think they look at, let's say, a Marcin Gortat, who just signed a 5-year, $60 million contract, as guys who are obtainable to them. I mean, you know, LeBron's he's a once-in-a-lifetime type talent, you know, on and off the court.
I talked to Keith Reed about this, and he was sort of saying when he was coming up that Michael Jordan was the once-in-a-lifetime player, and his off-the-court money-making was all about endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
And that now, if you're using LeBron as the once-in-a-lifetime player, it's about, you know, equity in Beats, that it's about having a slice of that company and building your own industry, really, and your own business. Do you see LeBron's business acumen changing the way the game is played and changing the way players see themselves?
Definitely. I commend LeBron and his team for the way they approach, off the court, building his business. They're not just trying to be endorsers. They're trying to be owners.
The guys you represent, what are they telling you this season? You know, what are they worried about, excited about? What do they think about when they are going into the season?
It's hard to believe, but they're fans just like, you know, we are. So they love basketball, and they're sitting back watching the landscape. They're interested to see what happens with, you know, the formation of another super team, possibly with Carmelo going somewhere else to challenge Miami or the Spurs.
Nobody in New York wants that, I gotta tell you.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think, you know, New York has a strong position because they can offer the most money.
All this stuff that's happening right now, why does this matter to the average fan?
Well, it affects the product that, you know, they consume for their enjoyment. I believe that the super teams in big markets are great for the NBA because either you love them or you hate them, but one way or another, you're watching. So the better the ratings are for the NBA, the better the business does in general, because TV is the cash cow now.
And speaking of that cash cow, let's do the weekend number. It's 18 million for 18 million viewers. That's how many people tuned in to watch the San Antonio Spurs beat LeBron James and his teammates on the Miami Heat in this year's NBA Finals, according to Nielsen. That's up 10% from last year. So all that Game of Thrones jockeying about free agents, that's to get you watching. Just ahead, why Facebook was manipulating some of its users' news feeds.
Facebook probably wants to understand how to advertise in ways that will influence our behavior as consumers.
Plus, the Internet of Everything will explore our connected future. That's next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. Welcome to my office.
Thanks.
You know, modest but nice, yes.
All right, so we're in your office because we are going to talk about Facebook. We're going to go on the computer and talk about this study Facebook was doing. It's not a new study, right?
Right. So the study was actually conducted in 2012, but there was a paper on the study recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It was published in June. And people have gotten up in arms about it, basically because this study, which was done on 700,000 users almost in 2012, didn't really inform the people that the study was being done on, of course. So the researchers affiliated with Facebook, Cornell, and UC San Francisco. And the idea was to tweak the news feed of users to show them mostly negative and neutral or mostly positive and neutral and see if that impacted their own posts. So if I see a bunch of negative posts, the question was, will I then post negative posts myself?
Well, I want to look at both of our Facebook feeds. We're sitting in your office. We're not in the studio so that we can do this in real life and see what's on there. We've got your Facebook feed up and mine. Let's look at yours. What's up there?
In my actual news feed here, I've got, you know, the typical friend posing with their dog photo, something about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, of course, we've got a very positive post from one friend who I won't name today. I'm thankful that we live in Boston, home of the world's best doctors. I don't know what that's about.
Do you think these are happy posts?
I think generally positive, right? We've got the dog and the friend. We've got the other friend being thankful for Boston. We've got people posting weird photos from the Daily News today. Yeah, I would say, you know, generally positive. Yeah. What about you?
Let's look at mine.
All right, cool.
In my feed, we have a run for Alzheimer's. We have got a reading that an author friend of mine is doing.
In Bryant Park, cool.
Somebody else who got married. That's
of course.
Big. Got a lot of weddings in your Facebook feed. And what else do we have below there? A temporary tattoo from a friend of mine who is a breast cancer patient. So it's a mix. I would say maybe somewhere positive, somewhere neutral. And then a lot of ads, of course. So looking at our feeds and thinking about what this study was, what did they find?
Basically, their finding was that, yes, it's true. If you and I are looking at mostly positive posts in our feed, we will be likely, more likely, to post positive things ourselves. Same with negative. If we see a bunch of negative stuff in our feed, we're going to be posting sad things about our life all the time. We should note there's an important distinction here, right? This is not actually proof that our emotions have necessarily been impacted. What it's proof of is that we will act in the way that the other online users are acting.
Why was Facebook doing this?
Like any social network, Facebook wants to understand its users, right? It wants to understand the data that they're posting. It wants to be helpful to its users by making the algorithms work for deciding what appears in your newsfeed, because as we both know, not everything appears in our newsfeed. It also wants to understand influence. It wants to understand how what we see influences our own behavior. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for Facebook to understand that. But as you and I both note, there's a lot of ads here. And in a basic sense, I think Facebook probably wants to understand how to advertise in ways that will influence our behavior as consumers.
A lot of people were upset or angry about this. What has Facebook's response been?
Basically, the company's response has been, you signed up for this. Facebook has a data use policy that is viewable. That data use policy covers things like this, at least in theory. The company basically says, when you sign up for Facebook as a user, you're giving us the right to pull your data, deliver data to you, and figure out ways to use that data in, they would say, ways that are useful to you, but also useful to them.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thanks for explaining it.
Thank you, Lizzie.
After looking at our own Facebook feeds, we kind of wanted to know, hey, what's in yours? So we asked.
Holidays and people's children, and if they've eaten out at a restaurant, you get a lot of food pictures.
Selfies, a lot of selfies, and I guess a lot of news about celebrities.
I'm a professional mechanic, and I normally have people in my field in social media looking for solutions in things that I cannot do by myself. You know, getting to know new equipment, new resources for the field.
I see a lot of baby photos because I'm in my 30s. Everybody's having babies and getting married. So I see a lot of those.
I usually see ridiculous political comments and pictures of a lot of children.
Silly stuff. Anything from BuzzFeed to like just a random article that I get a giggle out of. Lots of babies. Really, a lot of babies. My age, I'm turning 35, so it's all people getting married, people having kids, stuff like that.
Now and then, we like to explore some of the big ideas changing our world, like the so-called Internet of Everything. In 2014, it's fair to say that most of us think of capitalism as the default economic system. Markets around the world are interconnected, and even communist countries like China buy and sell internationally. Our next guest, though, argues that capitalism is, in effect, eating itself, that we've gotten so good at making things cheaply that everyone can, thanks to the Internet. He's Jeremy Rifkin, an economic theorist who's advised the European Union, and his latest book is called The Zero Marginal Cost Society. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Nice to be with you.
I'd like you to explain the concept of the zero marginal cost society, because people sitting out there might go, well, Hannah, what's that?
Well, let me put it in context. What we're beginning to see is the emergence of a new economic system. It's called the collaborative commons. This is actually the first new economic system to emerge since the advent of capitalism and socialism. So it's a remarkable historic event, and it's going to dramatically affect all of our lives very intimately. And the triggering event is something called zero marginal cost. There is a paradox deeply embedded in the heart of capitalism. Sellers are always probing for new technologies so they can put out cheaper products, win over consumers in market share, and bring some profits back to their investors. It's just that no one ever expected in their wildest imagination a technology revolution whose productivity is so extreme that it would reduce those marginal costs to near zero, making goods and services essentially priceless, nearly free, abundant, and no longer subject to the marketplace. The internet is morphing into a super internet, and it's the communication internet is now coming together with a very fledgling energy internet and a nascent automated logistics and transport internet to create a single super internet of things, this platform. It's like a nervous system, like a brain. And what it allows us to do is any enterprise can go up on this emerging internet of things and have access to the data being fed across the system. And then you can use your own mobile in your own apps. So you can increase your productivity dramatically, reduce your marginal costs, and create your own energy, your own products, and your own services.
Hold on a minute there, though. One of the assumptions that is embedded in that, and particularly with the Internet of Things, is the idea of language that, say, all of these devices are speaking, right? If you've got a refrigerator that's talking to your TV, if they are communicating with open source software, then yes, it might exist in the collaborative commons. But if Samsung doesn't want you using your mobile in its language, explain to me how this moves beyond a couple of large companies controlling those networks.
Will the Internet of Things result in the monopolization of everything on the planet or the democratization of everything on the planet?
Yeah.
Or somewhere in between? Let's take renewable energy. We now have millions of consumers who become prosumers, and they're actually producing their own solar and wind green electricity at near zero marginal cost. But even before you pay back the fixed cost for your solar panel or your wind turbine, the marginal cost of producing that energy is nearly free because the sun is free over your property. You just have to capture it. Or the wind flowing across your property is free. Or the geothermal heat underneath your ground is free. You just have to capture it. And what this has meant for the big power companies in Germany is very interesting. What we found there is the producers of this new electricity are not the big, powerful global energy companies. It's millions of small players who have created their own producer co-ops, and they are putting on the installation of solar and wind, and they're enjoying near zero marginal cost production of energy.
I want to get a little bigger. There is, I think, a thread that runs through this book and has come through some of your previous work, which is this question of empathy and really good faith that you seem to have in human nature. Maybe I'm too much of a cynic, but what do you do with the question of profit motive, right? Don't people want to make money?
What's interesting here is economists say, how else would you run an economy if there's no profit? They think there's only two ways to run an economic system, either private enterprise or government or some combination of two. And what they forget, there's another whole institution that everyone on this planet relies on every day. It's called the social economy. Some of it's the nonprofit, some of it's formal and informal. But we have millions of organizations that provide all sorts of goods and services, from healthcare, school systems, environmental groups, arboretums, assisted living for the elderly, sports, culture, arts. It goes on and on. But they're not considered by economists because they create social capital, not market capital.
Do you worry at all when you envision this society about the poor, about the folks who are not online and who do not have access to a lot of these internet-driven services, that they could be left behind?
I think that near zero marginal cost is our way to deal with the tremendous inequality between the rich and poor. The architecture of the Internet of Things is designed to be democratic. If it stays network neutral, it means hundreds of millions of people in the developing world, as well as the industrial world, are going to be able to access this Internet of Things and going to be able to produce their own green electricity locally at near zero marginal cost. They're going to be able to produce their own 3D printed products at near zero marginal cost, and they're going to be able to share them on vast collaborative commons. And this is going to really, I think, create a great democratization of the economy and not to mention a more ecological society. So I think the real winners here are going to be the developing world, absolutely.
Jeremy Rifkin, author of The Zero Marginal Cost Society, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Marketplace Weekend is supported by the investment firm of Raymond James, Wealth Management, Banking, and Capital Markets. Learn more at lifewellplanned.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Money's everywhere in our world, and it becomes even plainer when the rules we live by start to change. Old systems no longer hold up, and you got to come up with new ways of doing things. That's happening right now in Colorado, since marijuana became legal 6 months ago. Now there's a new issue: what to do with all the money that's been generated. That's at least $11 million in taxes alone, because banking with marijuana money, that still isn't legal. So we called up Mike Elliott, the executive director of the Marijuana Industry Group, and I asked him how many people he represents. Here's what I'm really curious about. You've got these members, right, in your group. How many of them are there?
So we have 27 individual owners that are members of the trade association. It's representing about 200 or so licenses here, marijuana businesses here in Colorado.
They got to pay dues to you, right?
Yep, that's right.
How do they do that?
So most of them actually pay in checks. And that's because, you know, it's probably about two-thirds of them have a bank account. I would describe it as being a don't ask, don't tell relationship with many of the banks. But
yeah, so does this mean basically that folks who have medical marijuana licenses are using banks and the banks are aware of that?
That's tough to know. And I think, you know, it probably changes in different circumstances. I think a lot of the business owners, the lower people in the banks, the tellers probably know exactly what's going on. And they don't lose their account until, you know, maybe something bad happens or the money smells like marijuana and the bank starts looking into it more. It is a very unstable environment right now. And even those people that have banks, they're very limited in how they can use the banks because, you know, you can't just take all the cash that you make and put it into a bank account because that would raise a red flag with the bank. So they have to be very tightly managed.
Yeah. Explain the background to us. Why aren't banks supposed to take deposits from folks who sell marijuana, even though it's legal in Colorado now?
So it's really an issue of federal law. There's a lot of federal laws that are in place and many different federal agencies that regulate the banks. So at the top is the Bank Secrecy Act, which puts a lot of requirements in place on the banks to basically prevent money laundering. And so that is one of the big concerns with federal law.
What do your members do with their money? Where do they put it?
So there's a lot of workarounds right now. So many of them have banks, which solves part of the problem. Many of them are just investing everything back into their business as quickly as they can, which, you know, that's a common thing for new business owners to be doing anyway. There's private arm security and private secure storage, you know, vaults that are protected.
Wait a minute. There are vaults where people, you know, stack their money?
Yes. What's happened here is that we've had a bunch of smaller, more Colorado-centric businesses pop up that are doing private arm security and private armor car services specifically for this industry. And, you know, it's working and they're doing quite well at it, but private secure storage is part of it. It is, it's vaults that are in locations that I have no idea where they are, and nobody should know where they are for security reasons. But yeah, I mean, basically they're storing cash and then they're helping to make payments. You know, they're going and paying, you know, the city of Denver taxes there and licensing fees and licensing and taxes for the state of Colorado. And even this absurd scenario of having to go and pay the IRS federal income taxes.
With cash from the vault?
In some cases, that's right. This has actually been a problem in the past, is that here we are needing to pay our federal income taxes, even though the federal government doesn't recognize our businesses as being legit, and having to do so in cash because we don't have a bank account. And the IRS then, you know, criticizing the industry and saying, we can't take cash, we need a check. And us coming back and saying, well, of course, we want to give you a check, but you need to not interfere with our banking relationships. It's a very frustrating and it's a silly problem to have.
There is a co-op of sorts in Colorado where vendors can put their money. Can you explain how that works to me?
Yes. So it was House Bill 1398 that passed through the Colorado State Legislature this year and was recently signed into law. No one's sure it's going to work. the determination of whether it works is really going to be whenever this co-op gets formed, they would go to the Federal Reserve and say to the Federal Reserve, we have a co-op here. We would like to access the ACH.
And the ACH is the automated clearinghouse. That's what you'd use if you've got direct deposit at work.
Yes, that's essentially right. And part of the reason why everyone is saying, you know, this probably isn't going to work is because everyone is expecting the Federal Reserve to say, no, co-op, you're not going to be allowed to do this.
I would imagine that your members are making a lot of money. Don't the banks want to make some money by doing business with you? I would imagine they're kind of saying, hey, this would be good for us.
It depends on your perspective, because we appear to be a very large, prosperous industry to many people. But to Wells Fargo, you know, we're probably just a drop in the bucket. I think that's one of the issues about this is that the banks in particular, they're very scared about this and scared about getting in trouble. And so they might test it out, but it's going to be done in a non-public sort of way.
Mike Elliott, thank you so much for talking with me.
Anytime. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
We reached out to both the Justice Department and the FBI's Financial Crimes Unit. We haven't heard back from either of them. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next week, we'll have some brunch and hear what you'd tell your 18-year-old self about money. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, John Sepulvedo, and Candice Manriquez. A special thanks this week to Abraham Musico. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend. This is APM.